Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from the Labor Relations Information System. Thanks for joining us. We'll be with you for the next 45 minutes or an hour or so while we go through recent developments in public safety labor relations. This is a special podcast. As you know, ownership of LRIS transitioned last year from me to the Philadelphia law firm of Willig, Williams, and Davidson. Rick Polson, a partner in that firm, is taking the lead on running LRIS and has been doing a great job over the course of the last year through a variety of seminars, shaking up our seminars a little bit, which in truth was long overdue. And Rick is going to be taking over the podcast in July. For the next 3 months, April, May, and June, Rick and I will do the podcast together. And we may well do it together in the future if there's something where banter is appropriate. I mean, who knows? So I want to start this podcast by introducing Rick Polson, and in particular, getting some information out that will allow you to get to know Rick in a personal and professional way before we dive into the cases. And we've got good cases. We've got an absolutely great Garrity case we're going to talk about this month and a wide variety of cases over the whole country. But, Rick, let's start with you. First, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Hi, Will. Thank you so much for allowing me to participate. This is great.
Oh, sure. You're going to find this to be a very unusual enterprise where you lock yourself in a dark room and talk to yourself for 45 minutes. It's going to be interesting.
Sounds like a typical Friday night for me.
Yeah. So, Rick, tell us a little bit about how you got here, where you grew up, where you went to college, law school, and how you ended up interested in labor relations.
Sure. Well, I hail from the great city of Philadelphia born and raised here, and I'm sitting in within the Philadelphia city limits right now. I'm speaking with you. I grew up in, Philadelphia's a pretty big city, a city of neighborhoods, and I grew up in a really big neighborhood we refer to here as Northeast Philly. And it's a row house neighborhood. When I grew up, it was lots of police officers and firefighters and letter carriers, et cetera, et cetera. My dad was in that group. He was a firefighter. Oh, he always said he should have been a mailman, but, you know, oh well. Growing up, you know, most of my friends' dads at that time, you know, because it was a long time ago, were, you know, police officers and firefighters. And so I always felt pretty close to uniformed services. And, you know, now a lot of my friends from growing up were police officers and firefighters. And, you know, the one thing I was not allowed to do was become a police officer or a firefighter. And
what about a mailman?
Mailman was always open. You know, that was his great regret. I should have taken that test. But went to school at LaSalle University in Philadelphia. That was where I did my undergrad work. And I went down to the great city of Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia, and did law school there at a different school from you, but not too terribly far away, at Catholic University of America.
It's a great law school. I love Catholic.
Had a great time there. And as you know, going to law school in Washington, such a wonderful experience, you know, just having the ability to go down to the Supreme Court and listen to argument, which I did, you know, is just really an extraordinary opportunity for law students. And I hope they still do it.
Wasn't that just a fascinating experience? I so strongly recommend going to law school anywhere you can in Washington, D.C. I mean, you do have the Supreme Court blocks away from you. You have perhaps the best federal court of appeals in the country there in the D.C. Circuit. You've got all these administrative agencies and Senate and House hearings, and it's all right there for you to sample.
Yeah, no, it was a great experience. And, you know, that we used to joke that nobody's from there, you know, and that was one of the fun things is that people were from all over, you know, all over the world living in Washington. So it was a great.
Except me, I was born in George Washington Hospital.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
Another, Another good law school in Washington, D.C.
I was born in an elevator in University of Pennsylvania Hospital, which probably explains
some things. Oh, that's a much better story.
And so, you know, I wound up in law school. I went to law school for the same reason that most people that go to law school have, and that's I had no options, no prospects, no idea what I wanted to do with my life. And so I went to law school and took a great labor law class in law school and was inspired by a wonderful professor. And it all came together for me that, oh gosh, this is what I'm supposed to do is represent workers and represent unions. And so I'm one of those weird people that, you know, I've known exactly what I wanted to do when I grew up. You know, from that moment on, you know, in law school, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. And I wanted to find a great place to practice this work. I didn't necessarily want to focus on any particular type of, industry or worker. I just wanted to represent unions. And it felt right given the way that I grew up. And I got really lucky. I wound up getting a position at my law firm where I'm at now, Willig, Williams & Davidson in Philadelphia. And so I got to come home to Philadelphia, which was, really what I wanted to do. Philadelphia is a very strange place. People who are from here don't like to leave here. Not sure what it is, but we really love it. And so I was able to get a job at Willig, Williams & Davidson. We're one of the biggest union side firms in the country. I thought it was the best firm. You know, it was where I wanted to work. And I was a little surprised that they hired me. 25 years later, I'm still a little surprised that I'm around, but I get to work with really wonderful people there. At that time, the firm represented Philadelphia's firefighter union. And so there was a real, a great fit for me to start working with my dad's old union. And we had a few police and fire clients that we worked with back then. And then over the last 20 some odd years, we've grown that practice to, now I work exclusively with public safety professionals, and that's police, fire, and corrections. Mostly in Pennsylvania, but I get to do it in lots of other parts of the country. And, doing the same stuff that you do, not as well, but doing the same stuff, day-to-day advice and counsel and working through grievances and interest arbitrations and negotiations and all that really, really important stuff. I really believe in collective bargaining and the ability that we have, to help our brothers and sisters, right? So, I was able to go to college because my dad had a union job and we had a place to live and food on the table. And he made it through that job safely, 28 years, and he retired, in decent health. It's a great opportunity to continue to do that.
It's just a wonderful practice, isn't it?
Yeah.
Not only get to be a lawyer in a very creative, unusual way, where you're not simply opening a book and following what's in a book. The results of your work, if you're doing it well, help people. You can go home every night with the feeling that you've made somebody's life maybe just a little bit better. I don't want to be too grand about what it is that we do, but it's a very emotionally rewarding practice, I found. You as well?
For sure. I used to joke about, and I don't want to slam lawyers, but I used to joke, I wanted to be a lawyer, but I also wanted to be able to look myself in the mirror and feel good about, what I do. And of course, now I know there's very many lawyers who are wonderful people that practice, in areas that you may not think have any, direct impact on the lives of working families, but they're still great, And of course, what we're saying about our experiences as lawyers on the union side, is equally true for, all of the good people I've met, who represent, management in labor negotiations. A good management labor lawyer that sees the big picture can really help people, right? Keep the employer in business, right? Keep them, taking care of their responsibilities in an effective and efficient way, but also doing so in a way that doesn't hurt people. And the best ones know how to do that.
I wonder if your career has had somewhat the same philosophical arc that mine has. When I first started representing police and fire and corrections, I practiced in states where interest arbitration was the last step of the negotiations process. And interest arbitration is a very structured in a way, very structured, and another way gives you the opportunity for tremendous creativity. But with interest arbitration, you got, you know, things like the cost of living and the employer's ability to pay and comparable jurisdictions and total compensation and all these different factors. And that's like a lawyer's toy box. And so when I started practicing, boy, I was headed towards interest arbitration by default as much as I possibly could be. And I got involved in actually developing different ways of getting into interest arbitration and having a good result. But over time, I've shifted. And I maybe started believing, I don't know, 5-10 years into my practice, that the best results I could get for my clients were in jurisdictions where I had a good relationship with whoever was on the other side, or my client had a good relationship with whoever the HR people were, or the fire chief or the police chief. And in the end, I have come to think that relationships are overwhelmingly the most important thing in collective bargaining, and that our job as lawyers, it may be from time to time to take out a big stick and go to hearing and be very aggressive in cross-examination. That may have to happen, but ultimately the best results are going to come from how you get along with the other side and how you nurture the relationship that is going to transcend us. When we're no longer practicing, these people are still going to be in a relationship. Have you come to think of things in that same way, or you have a different approach?
No, I feel exactly the same way. You know, it's, you know, I think when you're younger, or certainly in my case, I'll speak for myself, when I was younger, entering into the field of labor relations, there was a real us versus them mentality, you know, and we were the good guys on the union side and management were the bad guys and we're going to fight, you know, and we're going to take them to arbitration and we're going to take them for all they're worth and all that good stuff. And you know, and sometimes we had to do that. And it was, I'm glad for the opportunities to have done that and to have learned to fight. And you know, I'm from Philly, we can fight a little bit, you know, and it's good to be able to do that. I think you have to be able to do that. And maybe only, maybe you have to go through that in order to reach the place where that you've reached and that I've reached is that, well, you know, they need to know that I can fight, but boy, I'd much rather if folks can just sit down and work their stuff out. And, you know, in the public sector, really in the private sector too, but in the public sector, the relationships are so important. You know, it's so, so important for the union and management to develop, you know, relationships that are credible. You know, after you and I are done, we can go to an arbitration. I can have a heck of a lot of fun and I can, you know, blow up a lot of, you know, relationships if I want, I guess, and leave. And but the parties have to live together after I'm gone. And, you know, I don't think it's a good thing to do that. And so if we can always try to, and you know this, it's LRAS's approach, and it's certainly been my approach, you know, with LRAS, and I think that's why it's been such a good fit, is that, you know, we counsel or at our seminars and everything we do, which are not just for union folks, right, for management folks too, you know, we advise people to keep your eye on the long haul, you know, develop that relationship, build it, sustain it. Of course, there are going to be times when we disagree, and sometimes we're going to disagree in, you know, in pretty significant ways, and it can get tough, like any family relationship. You know, the relationship, being able to develop and maintain, that's really important. You know, and so that's certainly my thing. I'd much rather reach a negotiated settlement than have an award, you know, any day of the week.
You know, the lawyer who captured it best for me, I won't use her name here because I don't have her permission, but she was an assistant municipal attorney up in the municipality of Anchorage in Alaska. And every once in a while, you run into a city attorney or county council's office where the person who became the labor lawyer for the employer was the person who wasn't in the room when they were doling out assignments. And that, in fact, is what happened to her. She was a zoning lawyer and got told one day, you are now in labor relations. She lasted about 3 years. She was great, very good to work with. We became very good friends. And we went out to lunch when she finally moved on to Washington, D.C. And she said, you know what I've told my friends at parties when they ask me what it's like to be a labor lawyer? I said, no. And she said, it's like being a divorce lawyer, only your clients can never actually get divorced.
Right. And
I thought right. that was such a brilliant way.
It's true. I mean, it's true, right? They're not going to, you know, they're not going to go away, right? You know, that the, you know, there are some very rare examples, but you know, the municipality, the county, they're not going to go away. They're still going to have a police department, right? And the police union's not going to go away. The police officers aren't going to go away. So we've got to figure out how to resolve our problems. And, you know, especially with public safety personnel who the overwhelming majority, right, aren't going to have a right to strike. They're not going to have that economic weapon. You know, we have interest arbitration and it's good to know how to use it. But man, if you go in, you know how this works. If we start out and say our goal is to get to interest arbitration, it's not going to go well in the long run. You know, we may win. You know, when I say win, you know, I'm air quotes for, you know, people who can't see me, you may win, you may get bigger raises or hold off things, but you know, think about what's going to happen on the other side. You know, they're not going anywhere. We got to live together the next 3 or 4 years. You think they're not going to get their pound of flesh? And flip side, if you screw your firefighter union, do you not think they're going to take it out on you? That's just human nature. And so that's what makes, I mean, from my perspective, when we're in interest arbitration, that's what makes interest arbitration so challenging, is to hopefully have, if we're talking about a typical interest arbitration system with a tripartite panel, let's say, okay, and we'll have a union arbitrator and a management arbitrator and then a neutral arbitrator, which is a pretty common setup right across the country. And boy, you know, it's a lot of responsibility among those three people to say we need to decide, we need to resolve things, but how do we do this in a way that decides a case in a manner reflected by the evidence and does so with an eye toward justice and takes into account the nature of the services performed by the bargaining unit, but also takes into account the fact that these folks have to live together, right? And it's really, you know, it's really hard. That last part is really hard. And that's why, you know, there's some really great arbitrators that do this work that get it. There's some really great management labor lawyers who get that. And when we've got three lawyers who understand that, we can usually wind up in interest arbitration at a right place, you know, but when we don't, you probably created about 10 or 20 years of problems. So,
right. Well, we better get to the cases.
Let's get to them.
We could talk about the practice of labor relations from the union side for this entire podcast, but we won't. So let's start with what I think of to be a nagging sort of Garrity case that comes out of the Youngstown, Ohio Police Department. Now, I'm sure everybody has a good understanding, or almost everybody does, of the Garrity rule. But just very, very briefly, Garrity is a decision of the U.S. Supreme Court from 1966, I think it is. At any rate, it goes way back. It's 50 years old at least. In Garrity, the Supreme Court had to address the very difficult question of what happens in a public employment setting where an employer is conducting a disciplinary or administrative investigation and wants to order employees to talk, to give a statement, a written statement or an oral statement. And because these are governmental employees, they are covered by the Fifth Amendment and the right not to be forced into compulsory self-incrimination. So what do you do with the Fifth Amendment rights of public employees? And the Supreme Court's answer was, employer, you have the right to order them to give a statement, but you pay a price when you do that. And that price is, you can't use the statement or the fruits of the statement to criminally prosecute the employee. So Garrity's a rule of immunity. It does acknowledge the right of an employer to force an employee to make a statement, even though this is the government forcing a citizen to make the statement. Garrity says that's okay in public employment, but you pay the price of immunity. And over the years since Garrity, we've had all sorts of rules develop as to what does it mean that you can't use the statement or the fruits of the statement. Do you have to give an employee warnings as to what their Garrity rights are? That the issue of warnings is not involved in the case we're going to be talking about today. So I'll signal the answer, and the answer is yes. An employer must give what have become known as reverse Garrity warnings or Garrity warnings. And you will go for a year or two seeing very few Garrity cases because these rules have become so well established and employers understand them. And then you tend to see an eruption of Garrity cases where maybe you've got a new set of people in internal affairs or whatever it might be, but all of a sudden you've got all sorts of Garrity issues where you didn't see them before. And that's where we are right now. We're seeing a mini eruption of Garrity cases, and it's frustrating to see that because you try to educate everybody, both the employer and employees, on Garrity rights of employees, and it's frustrating when you see it's not taking root. And it's frustrating for courts. And when we saw this opinion from the Ohio Court of Appeals coming out of Youngstown, this is a great example of a court saying, what part of what we have said half a dozen times do you not understand? Here are the rules again. So what happens in this Ohio case? This involves a lieutenant by the name of Brian Flynn. There's going to be several names involved as I run through the facts of what happened in this case. Remember, Flynn is the one who's going to be accused. Flynn had job duties that included being the head of the city's Internet Crimes Against Children unit. The city became concerned that Flynn was not doing his job adequately, and they started an internal affairs investigation and assigned Lieutenant Brian Butler to do the internal affairs investigation. So now here's our second lieutenant with the first name of Brian involved in this case. So Butler interviews Flynn. Flynn makes several statements. Those statements are all reduced to writing, and a big file of the entire investigation is sent to an assistant prosecutor, where, as the court puts it later, the file remained for some time. The city eventually moves on this whole thing, arranges for the local sheriff's office, the Summit County Sheriff's Office, to do a criminal investigation. And a detective by the name of Brian Breeden, yes, indeed, we have three Brians in this case, Breeden gets assigned. He gets the file from the city's law director, and Breeden looks through the file. He immediately identifies that there's Garrity information. Information was compelled out of the mouth of Flynn. He immediately identifies that there's this information in the file, and he does the right thing. He separates it, and he doesn't look at it again. So he's created a wall between the portions of the city's investigation that did not involve Garrity statements and the portion that did. The criminal investigation culminates, we're now all the way up to 2022, with 14 misdemeanor dereliction of duty complaints being filed against Flynn. And Ohio is one of the few states that still has a criminal dereliction of duty statute on the books. It's a misdemeanor, and that's what the city is doing here, is bringing these 14 criminal charges. The basic charge, or the basic allegation that runs through all 14 charges, is that while Flynn was the person in the PD designated to receive, assess, and act on cyber tips from the ICAC, the Internet Crimes Against Children data system, while he was the point person on that, he intentionally did not do his job. He didn't review the tips, he didn't assess them, he didn't act on them, and worse, he intentionally instructed his subordinates to do the same thing. So now we have 14 misdemeanors that are filed, which does seem a little bit like overkill, even though you don't actually know what the separate allegations are from the court's opinion. Flynn responds the way you would expect. He files a motion to dismiss the complaint, all 14 complaints, saying you violated Garrity. He also files what's called an alternative motion in case he doesn't win the motion to dismiss. And the alternative motion is he wants all the Garrity material suppressed. And the whole thing goes before a trial court. And the trial court, at the trial court, the prosecution does its job with respect to Breeden. This is the county investigator. And proves that Breeden didn't use any Garrity materials. However, the prosecution fails to submit any evidence as to what happened to the Garrity materials while they were still in the possession of the city, before they got sent over to Breeden at the county. No evidence whatsoever. And the trial court says, you know what? You got an obligation to prove that you did not use these materials or the fruits of these materials. You didn't prove that with respect to the city files. Case dismissed. Cases, 14 cases dismissed in one fell swoop. The city appeals to the Ohio Court of Appeals, and this is where you get a court who that is really clearly ticked off that this case is even before it. The court says, we've got a string of cases. They go back to at least 1992. And those cases say that if there are Garrity statements floating around out there, floating around in the ether, in the employer's files, in a prosecutor's files, heaven forbid, that the government must prove that it did not make any, you can underline and boldface and italicize and put that font in red, any use of compelled statements in the criminal case, and must prove that there's an independent source for all of the allegations or proof against the employee. The court says, you know what these cases have said? And this is a direct quote from the most important of them, which is a decision out of the Ohio Supreme Court called State versus Jackson. It's one of the most important Garrity cases in the country. We'll post that decision in the show notes. What the Court of Appeals says is this string of cases means that the employer or the state can make no use whatsoever of compelled statements in a criminal prosecution. And the court said, you know what? Look at what happened here. We had materials that were in possession of the city's law department for a significant amount of time. The law director sat on those materials. The law director is the one who filed the probable cause affidavits that resulted in criminal charges against Flynn. And when the state got into the trial court, it could not explain even how long the files were in the possession of the law department or what steps the law department took to prevent the Garrity information from, and I'm quoting the court here, infiltrating the criminal investigation. Now, the state's answer is, look, the burden of proof here is not on us. The burden of proof is on Flynn to show that we made inappropriate use of the Garrity materials. And the Court of Appeals says, wrong. The burden of proof is on the government to show that no materials or the fruits of the materials were used in the charging decision or in, if you actually get to a trial, in a trial. And the state says, okay, well, I guess we understand that, but dismissal of all of these charges, that seems pretty inappropriate. That seems like a way too heavy sanction. And the Court of Appeals said, what part about we've decided these cases since 1992, aren't you seeing here, state? Dismissal of the criminal charges is the only appropriate remedy in these sorts of cases. And result, the court ends up upholding the trial court's opinion, dismissing all 14 charges. Look, what you have to do with these rules of constitutional procedure or basic labor law like Garrity or like Weingarten, whenever you get a new crew of people, either on the employer side or in the union side who were involved in disciplinary investigations, they need good education on what these rules say. Otherwise, you're going to end up with a scolding from the court. Rick, thoughts about this case?
Yeah, you know, the first thing I thought about, you know, when we looked at this case was, these dereliction of duty charges. If you're ever going to be at risk of a Garrity issue, right? If you ever want to make sure that you're extra super sure that you're, that you one know the rules and are applying the rules, it would be in a dereliction case, right? And so it makes me wonder. I read cases, and I know I'm a lawyer. I'm supposed to think about the law. I read cases, and I think about the people, and I think about what was going on, right? You know, what was happening here, and why did they choose to even bring, you know, one of these counts, let alone 14, and, you know, just fire them, right? But in any event, you know, that's what I think about it. And I agree that we got to train new people. You know, it's basic stuff, and especially in the government end, there's lots of turnover, you know, in these solicitors' offices and law departments. And I know, they do their best at training, but you got to keep doing it. You know, why do we talk about this stuff? Right. You know, we talk about it because there are still cases and there's lots of confusion. You know, I don't understand why, but there's lots of it. And we talk about it. We'll be talking about it in June at our Rights of Police seminar in Las Vegas. We'll be talking about it, in November at our Discipline for Police seminar in Las Vegas. And as long as there's folks out there screwing it up, we got to keep talking about it.
Yeah. And one piece of advice here for employers. Sometimes you tend to think of Garrity and its principles only applying to uniformed employees, public safety employees, or maybe even only police officers. Garrity applies to all public employees, and some of the most powerful Garrity cases out there actually involve other than uniformed employees. So for employers, you got to make sure it's not just your police and fire and corrections and dispatchers who are getting the education on what Garrity requires. It's got to be managers in all of your departments who understand this. Well, Rick, over to you for our next case.
Okay. Well, case number two is from the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. I figured, why wouldn't I start out with a Pennsylvania case? And when I said Commonwealth. So, you know, what is a Commonwealth? How is a Commonwealth different from a state? And if I, you know, if you were to ask what's the difference between a state and a Commonwealth, I would say seven letters, because there's really not any difference. There's no functional difference between a state like Pennsylvania, a Commonwealth, and there's three other Commonwealths, Virginia, Massachusetts, and believe it or not, Kentucky, that, you know, we all think that we're more statier than other states, but we're really not. There's no functional difference. So when I refer to the Commonwealth, that doesn't mean anything special other than that's what Pennsylvania is. And the case comes out of a place called Frackville, Pennsylvania, which is about 100 or so miles northwest of where I'm sitting today talking to you about these stuff. It's right in the heart of mining country, and the town is called Frackville. And so I naturally go to the conclusion, this is where they invented fracking, right? It must be. And of course, that's completely wrong. It's called Frackville because the town was founded by some guy named Dan Frack. So it just made too much sense to not be true. But, you know, so good for Dan Frack. George Mitchell invented fracking, by the way. And so the reason why we picked this case is because it speaks, it's a pretty straightforward appeal of an arbitration award case, but it speaks to a couple of issues that I think are really relevant right now. And, you know, we see lots of cases coming down the pike addressing these things. And the first thing that it addresses, and it's a corrections case, by the way, it's called Department of Corrections versus the Pennsylvania State Correctional Officers Association. And this is the statewide prison system in Pennsylvania, and they're the union that represents the COs. And so one deals with correction officers, and it deals with mandatory overtime, right, recruiting and retention issues, and an injury sustained by an officer who was working a mandatory overtime shift. And I think that, you know, while the case is straightforward, it raises some interesting questions. And so, and from my perspective, it's an example of really bad management. And I'm a union lawyer. Nothing makes me happier than to point out examples of bad management. But I will tell you, when there's good management, I'm happy to point that out too. And this was, I think, a pretty bad decision, which we kind of see these things when we deal with insurance-related things. And when you start taking an insurance adjuster mentality, I see employers start to get into trouble. And so anyway, this is a work-related injury case involving a correctional officer named Justin Kirshner. And so Justin was a correctional officer at the State Correctional Institute in Frackville, Pennsylvania. He had about 12 years on the job, right, at the time of this incident. So he wasn't a new person, right? So 12 years, pretty senior correctional officer. He works his regular shift during the day. And I should also note that this is a facility where the correctional officers are working 8-hour shifts. So it raises these interesting questions, I think, of shift length, which we're dealing with in all of the public safety realm, but in corrections, questions about, do we work 8s? Do we work 10s, 12s? What's the safest? What's the best for staffing, et cetera? They work 8s in the state system. And so Justin worked his 8-to-4 shift without incident, no problem. He goes home. He lives about an hour away from Frackville. Gets home about 5 o'clock. And he's not home too long, and he gets a call. You know, Justin, you got to come back into work. Well, Justin, do you want to come back into work? And Justin says, no, I don't want to come back into work. For the 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. shift, right, the overnight shift, he just gets home. It's 5 o'clock. They ask him if he wants to work. He says, no. They say, well, we're going to mandate you to come in. And Justin has no ability to say no. He's mandated pursuant to the process that they use. So he has to go back into work, right, for a 10 p.m. shift after leaving one that ended at 4 o'clock. Justin goes back to work. He says he's tired, right? He's got concerns about whether he can do his job or not. They fall on deaf ears, and he returns to work. He shows up. Works his 10 to 6 shift. His assignment that night was to patrol the exterior. So he's in a unit. He's in a patrol unit. He's at the exterior of the facility. So he's driving. And around 4 a.m., you know, he made it pretty far into his shift. At about 4 a.m., he fell asleep at the wheel, right, while driving, falls asleep, and he crashes his car into a garage. Justin sustains injuries, you know, fairly serious injuries. And he's out of work for some period of time. He files a claim for work-related benefits under the contract. Now, let me take a step back. In Pennsylvania, and we see this in other states, but in Pennsylvania, there's a general workers' compensation law. And then there's a special law. It's not a part of the workers' compensation law. It's a different law. It's called the Enforcement Officer's Disability Law that provides enhanced benefits for essentially uniformed services, police, fire, corrections. And what that will provide is 100% of pay. And it will provide that only for temporary disabilities and only for disabilities sustained in the performance of your duties. And as you might expect, it would make too much sense for the standards of the workers' comp law and the enforcement officer's disability law to be the same. They're different. It's a higher bar for the enforcement officer's law. We also call that, by the way, the Heart and Lung Act, because once upon a time it only applied to heart and lung injuries. Now it doesn't. And so any injury is covered under the Heart and Lung Act. And if you ask, why is it so complicated? Why do we have laws that are called the Heart and Lung Act when they apply when you injure your knee or something like that? It's because, you know, we need something for lawyers to do. Otherwise, we really wouldn't have too much to do. So we know the answers. Justin files a claim for Heart and Lung Act benefits. His claim is denied. And the reason was, the reason raised by the employer was that, you know, Justin, last time we checked and read your job duties, it did not include sleeping, right? So sleeping is not a part of the job for a correctional officer. And so you were not injured in the performance of your duties. We denied the claim. What Justin did and what the union did on his behalf was they filed a grievance. They didn't file a state claim under in that particular contract. And this is not unusual in Pennsylvania. The contract incorporated the standards of the Heart and Lung Act, and employees were permitted to file grievances over disputes related to that act. And so Justin pursued his claim via the contractual grievance and arbitration procedure. He files a grievance and goes to arbitration, and he wins. And, you know, what was the reason identified by the arbitrator or argued by Justin at arbitration? It was, well, I wasn't attempting to sleep. I was driving while I was sleeping. This isn't a case where somebody went to the far corner of the institution and curled up for a long night's rest. I'm sure that's never happened. He was driving and he fell asleep at the wheel and crashed. And so while sleeping is not a part of the job, driving and patrolling the institution certainly is a part of the job. And I believe that I'm entitled to benefits because of that. And he won. The arbitrator agreed with Justin. And the arbitrator noted, and this is a case with great facts, Justin's testimony, I love his testimony at the arbitration, which is cited in the decision, saying, it's an hour commute to go home. So by the time I got home, it's 5 o'clock. In order for me to leave, I have to leave my house to get to work by 9. So I have to be ready by 8:30. I get home, I shower, I eat, I tried to sleep. I couldn't in the 2 hours, you know, I've had the opportunity to sleep, and then I went to work. So I didn't get any sleep at all, right? These are what we call good facts. Now, interesting wrinkle here, right? If we have, a pretty sympathetic story of an officer who is home, doesn't have time to sleep, is called into work, and maybe is at particular risk of falling asleep, you might say, well, why didn't you call off, right? Why did you even put yourself in position to fail in the first place? And in this particular case, the employee had done exactly that. You know, there's testimony on the record that Mr. Kirshner, Officer Kirshner, had refused similar mandates to come in on the basis that he had just gotten home, he wouldn't have ample time to sleep and return to work. And in fact, he had been disciplined for those refusals in the past. The arbitrator in his award relied on that and relied on, I would say, a common sense interpretation of what it means to be in the performance of your duties if you fall asleep while driving. But the arbitrator noted that, you know, Mr. Kirshner had refused similar mandated overtime shifts in the past, those which did not, in his opinion, give him the ability to sufficiently rest before the overtime shift. Kirshner had been given a reprimand for these refusals and understood that further discipline would result from similar refusals, right? So the arbitrator says he can't call out, or at least in his mind, he would be subjecting himself to discipline. And when he showed up and crashed his car into a garage because he fell asleep while driving it, I believe that that's consistent with the performance of his duties and that Officer Kirshner is eligible for benefits. What did the Commonwealth do? They appealed, of course, right? They appealed this to the statewide appellate court, which is called the Commonwealth Court in Pennsylvania. And the court, you know, dispatched this appeal pretty easily. You know, we report out at LRAS and we talk about occasionally attempts by employers and unions to challenge arbitration awards, right? And we know it's really difficult to do that. And while there are different standards in different states, the standard in effect for correctional officers, or at least these correctional officers in Pennsylvania, was what we call the essence test, right? Nothing new here. It's a private sector standard. And a reviewing court is going to say, listen, you know, we don't want to hear these appeals. If you have a contract and you have a dispute resolution system and it ends in arbitration, and it usually says final and binding arbitration, don't come to us with an appeal. And as long as the arbitration award draws its essence from the contract, as long as it, you know, it looks like an arbitrator interpreted the language and gave you a decision, you got the benefit of your bargain, right? You didn't bargain for a good award or a bad award or a fair award or an award written in English or an award, any type of, you just got an award. And so they're going to really try to stay away from disturbing awards unless it's a really exceptional case. And that's what the Commonwealth Court instructed in this case. And they said, this is an essence test case. You went to arbitration, you got an award, why are you bringing that to us? But the court went a little further and agreed with Mr. Kirshner, I think, in a message to the Commonwealth of, you know, hey, why did you even do this here? You know, and the court says in this case, Mr. Kirshner was indisputably on duty at the time of his injuries, right? As he was in the midst of performing the obligatory task of patrolling the perimeter of the prison that he was assigned to do. Consequently, the only question here is whether Mr. Kirshner's act of inadvertently falling asleep while performing his assigned duty precludes an award of HLA benefits. Now, when the court sets up the question that way, you know you're going to be in a pretty good position to get a good answer. And they did. So the court rejected the appeal, and Mr. Kirshner got his awards. You know, what are some of the takeaways here? This speaks to mandatory overtime and corrections, right? And you know what really jumps out to me? Here's a 12-year guy. Right. And he's being mandated to come in for midnight shift. He's not a 2-year person. And so that tells me that there's lots of mandatory overtime in the system. Why is that? Because they can't get enough people to come and work in the system. Why is that? Well, because they have the mindset where they try to screw people out of benefits potentially for falling asleep when they work too much. Or maybe there are a whole host of other reasons. But I think that it's interesting because it speaks to that. And it also raises issues about 8-hour shifts and shift rotations and, you know, whether there are ways for, you know, good employers and good unions to try to stack those shifts in a way that can hopefully minimize situations where people are working too many hours and they wind up in the position that Mr. Kirshner was in. You know, it also, you know, is just a really good example of bad management. It's a bad decision to try to beat somebody out of benefits. That usually is a decision that's out of the hands of management labor council, especially with insurance matters. And it's a challenge, I would imagine, on the employer's side to address those things. But those were the things that stood out to me. But it was a case where I think we had the right outcome. An employee that deserved benefits received them. And that's why we're talking about it.
Okay, help me out with this case. I started reading the facts of this case, and for people who don't read court opinions regularly, usually cases start off with a recitation of what happened. And in this case, I see that Justin, that's his first
Justin.
Name. I see that Justin is called back to work, and he's called back to work after working a full shift. And I'm pretty convinced that what this case is all about is what's called the going and coming rule. And the going and coming rule in workers' compensation says that when you are going to work or coming home from work and you get injured in some way, most of these are automobile accidents, when you get injured, that's not a compensable workers' compensation injury. But there's an exception to the, or several, but one that's pertinent to the going and coming rule. And it applies with, in particular, emergency services personnel like police, fire, and corrections. And that is when you're called back to work and it's not your regular shift and you get injured, most states are going to treat that as a compensable injury. So I'm reading the facts here, and I'm thinking, okay, this is going to be a going and coming case, and I don't know how Pennsylvania is on this rule. This could be interesting. And then I read the next paragraph, and it turns out he's injured while at work. What in the world is going on here? It's not like, as you say, he's going over and curling up in some
right.
corner of the correctional facility, or thinking of some other cases, having sex with somebody in that corner of the correctional institution.
Right.
Instead, this is someone who's doing his job when he is injured. There's no accidentally fell asleep defense in workers' compensation.
Yeah.
Now, so what in the world was happening here?
I don't.
Why did the employer make this decision?
I have no idea, and I'd love to know. My guess is that they're probably using artificial intelligence, and they tagged the word sleeping automatic denial, right? And so in Pennsylvania, we don't have laws prohibiting that yet. So if you want to learn about that, you can hit our webinar on AI and public safety, by the way, which dropped yesterday. But I don't know what they did. I think it was just bad management. But it's like saying, you know, a police officer gets punched while, you know, apprehending somebody. Well, getting punched is not on your job description. Well, that wasn't what I was trying to do. So I don't know what was happening. I do think that whenever we deal with work-related injury issues, that we are at more of a risk of getting some of these really kind of small-minded decisions. And I do think we have the insurance kind of mentality creeping in. And so that could be part of it, where you have outside insurance companies that are running these benefits. And I also think that it could speak to the larger issue of they don't have enough bodies to do the work, right? And they don't want to, you know, they want to do everything they can to make sure that, I haven't the foggiest idea.
You know, that's the other thing that struck me about this case was the 8-hour shift.
Yeah.
I mean, what correctional facilities today still have 8-hour shifts? The recruitment and retention crisis in public safety is maybe even most acute in corrections today.
For sure.
Maybe has even eclipsed police. And I don't know. Out on the West Coast, we have corrections officers working 9s, 10s, yeah, 11s, 12s, working pretty much anything but 8 hours. I was shocked to see that
here. There's still a few that do. And, the problem is that it's hard to make those significant changes in shift length when you're always short-staffed, right? And so if we take a place that's working 8s and we say, hey, we want to convert you over to 12s, now you have somebody who's there 12. Well, what happens if they get stuck, right? Remember, we're talking about a case where somebody went home and was called back. And that's, you know, makes me think of who was working middle shift that didn't get stuck. You know, I mean, a lot of times correction officers need to remind management that, you know, we're not inmates. We can actually leave, right? You know, and, you know, a lot of times they're not allowed to. And so if you're working 12 and then you get mandated, we're working 16, 20. It can be problematic, but it does seem to be that's probably the best practice would be a 12-hour shift. I would love to see more science on that, on what the safest shift is. But
there's surprisingly little science,
yeah, I know,
on the impact of shift length on metrics the employer would care about. So like the rate of industrial accidents or the rate of incidents that result in lawsuits or the rate of utilization of sick leave. There's surprisingly little evidence. We do know, I mean, there is a big body of science out there that once you get past 10 hours in a shift, you're going to see degradation of performance.
Yeah.
That's just human beings. A lot of studies involving doctors and nurses, that should make you feel comfortable as to what happens when they're working long hours. But you're right. We need to study this more. So, Rick, we've managed to go through our time allotted for the podcast and talk about only two cases.
Yeah.
Next month, we'll do better, and we'll save the cases that we have stacked up here and talk about a bunch of them. This has been fun. I've really enjoyed this conversation, and you're going to do great in this podcast as we move forward.
Well, it's fun stuff to talk about. Hopefully you'll continue to banter with me as we go on. It's a lot of fun. And hopefully, you know, if folks are listening, you know, if you like it, let us know. You know, we were interested in that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, to all of our listeners, thank you for joining us. This is Rick Polson and Will Aitchison, signing off.